Welcome back, everybody. We're now in, what is this, our post-season, I guess? Season 3 has come to an end, and now we're just having fun with special bonus episodes through the end of the year and into January, and then Season 4 will start at the end of January. But I'm glad you're here today because we're going to talk to one of my best friends and a guy who knows more about UFOs and UFO cases than anyone else I know, as well as having experiences of his own. It's Rob Christofferson. And we talk about everything. Bigfoot, is Bigfoot male or female, or neither, or both? Crop circles, UFOs, ghosts, and most important, what's the best Halloween candy? But before we start, I just want to say, you know, if we don't get to talk before Thanksgiving, you know, don't forget about Thanksgiving. We seem to go from Halloween straight into Christmas. If you've been to stores, you know what I'm talking about. But I love Thanksgiving. I'll be down in Atlanta with Susan and the whole family. I don't know where you'll be, but I hope your Thanksgiving is a quiet, calm moment before whatever the madness of Christmas is descends on you. I'm that annoying guy who always insists that we go around the table and everyone say what you're thankful for. And I'll tell you, I am thankful for this show, everybody who works on this show, and I'm thankful for all of you listening to it. This show and you guys have gotten me through the last couple of years, no question. The experience of writing the traditional RHPB episodes and then hearing from you guys and how it makes you feel, that's more than I could have ever expected or hoped for from any creative endeavor I've ever been involved with. And I want you to know how much I value it and value you. And I want to keep doing this as long as I possibly can. So what are you thankful for? You know, if you want, shoot me an email. Let me know. Maybe I'll read some on the air. Just shoot me an email from the website. I don't know. I'd be curious to know what you're thankful for. I guess I feel like it's good to focus on gratitude because it's easy to get caught up in tough times and all the things that we're all going through in our lives, but it actually feels really good to take a minute and focus on the things that make us feel joy and make us feel complete as human beings. So let me know. I'll tell you one thing. I am thankful for Rob Christofferson. So let's get into it. Here we go. Rob, I know who you are, and you know who you are, and you know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
But and my audience actually is quite familiar with you. There's people on the Facebook group who reach out consistently and say, "What's up with Rob?" And let's talk to Rob. So I'm like, "Yeah, let's talk to Rob." And I've been on your show. You're the host of the On Again, Off Again podcast, Our Strange Skies, that, by the way, was featured in 40 and Times.
It absolutely was. I have that issue kicking around here somewhere. But
which,
yeah,
makes you like a hero of mine. And you didn't know about it. Like, I still subscribe to 40 and Times. An issue came from England. So I was getting like the May issue in mid-August or something. And I'm just reading it like a normal adult male reads 40 and Times. And I get to the back page, and for a while there, they were doing podcast reviews, and there's your podcast.
Yeah. I remember you like messaged me and you're like, "Did you know you got reviewed 40 and Times?" I'm like, "No." didn't even know anybody from 40 and Times cared, but yeah, you sent me the magazine and I'm like, it's a pretty positive review. Criticisms were valid at the time, but I had already started to transition away from what their criticisms were, which the main criticism was this guy only covers American cases, and like that was the conceit of Our Strange Skies at the beginning, was I'm gonna cover the American stuff. Like the original logo that I had, a friend of mine in podcasting, Sam Fredrickson, he used to co-host a show called the Not Alone Podcast, which is one of my all-time favorite podcasts. He was an absolute amazing storyteller. And I paid his sister to make the logo for me. And the original logo is a UFO shooting a beam down at a man who's holding an American flag. So, yeah, that was the original conceit for the podcast. And I'm like, this is dumb. Like, there's a whole slew of UFO cases out there. So I kind of started to widen the net, so to speak, on what I started covering,
Well,
So.
the people who know you, and certainly in my point of view, I think of you as kind of a living encyclopedia of UFO cases. For years since I met you through Astonishing Legends, I can't count the number of times I've just texted you going, "Hey, has there ever been a case where someone has seen a UFO from above?" And like within 30 seconds, you write me a long text back. Or do people like, are there a lot of cases where people see multiple UFOs, or is it always just one? And then you'll write back to me a bunch of information that you're re clearly not, you're not checking a text. You're just remembering details. And I think for me, that's kind of your great skill, and that's the fun of you. I can sort of just throw anything like, okay, UFO plus cat, any cases?
And then, of course, you get good old Linda Moulton Howe talking about Bigfoot ripping cats in half. That like it's like 6 degrees from, everything. And yeah,
Wait a second,
like
tell me that case. What happened? Linda Moulton Howe.
so for a period of time, and I think she still does it, Linda Godfrey, or sorry, not Linda Godfrey, God, Linda Moulton Howe, she would talk about cases in which people were reporting their cats like being found ripped in half. And the narrative was that it was Bigfoot doing it. Like there were people claiming that Bigfoot was doing this. I've read cases in which, people have had like psychic contact with Bigfoot, had kind of a conversation, and Bigfoot for some reason has shown interest in cats. I don't know, but like it was something that she would harp on when she would go in and give presentations at whatever con she was at. I had a friend tell me who went to, it was a conference in Colorado that I think David Politis was speaking at, she was speaking at, there's a bunch of other people, and he talked about how she went on for like 45 minutes about Bigfoot ripping cats in half.
Well,
So.
okay, first of all, let's make it very clear. This is a very pro cat podcast.
Oh yeah. I have a cat too,
Yeah.
so.
So hopefully this discussion of violence towards cats isn't triggering anyone, but the idea I'd never heard that killing house pets was necessarily universally associated with Bigfoot.
Right. It's not, it's kind of the fringe kind of community talking about it. And the reason I laugh is because it sounds absurd as hell.
Yeah.
Because like people are talking about residential areas where you wouldn't normally think of Bigfoot being in. So
Right.
like certain areas and of like I pretty sure she was getting at certain areas of California. I'm like, and the first
Well,
time hearing this, it was just like the absurdity's built into these topics. It's
right.
what this stuff thrives on. But like, I think people take it to a bigger level than it ever needs to be. Like most of the time, it is like the absurdity's there. It doesn't need to become more absurd. And some people in this kind of community definitely take it to its limits.
Well, it's funny because where do you draw the line between, okay, this is just absurd enough? For me personally, I kind of just go by the numbers. It's like at a certain point when you hear something often enough, from, you know, a disparate group of people over a wide geographical range, you begin sort of generally going, well, okay, maybe that's a part of this phenomenon.
Yeah.
And, but it, what's, and I don't know if it's fair or not, or if it's just a human instinct to sort of go, well, I've never heard that happen before in a UFO case or a Bigfoot case or whatever. Therefore, I'm going to reject it, because who knows, 20 years from now, it may be, oh yeah, Bigfoot is a creature that murders cats. We all know this. We always knew this.
Right. Right. And that's the thing about, you know, cryptid encounters and Bigfoot encounters, is like, there's always going to be different spins on it. And one of the most interesting things about Bigfoot is like, they're regionally different in many ways. Like, you know, the ones in Florida are shorter, they have longer arms, and they have redder hair. And you go into the Pacific Northwest, they're really tall, they have darker colored hair, and you've got like different regional names for them all. You know, you got the Ohio Grassman, Florida Skunk Ape, you got Sasquatch, you've got all of that stuff. Like, the fact that there are so many regional differences makes it that much more fascinating, which kind of makes it seem like it's a terrestrial phenomenon, even though like it has very odd features to it at times, especially like when you talk about these creatures like disappearing out of nowhere. But like, the lore right. doesn't really change that much. It never really changes. It's like, it's a core set of lore that like, it has certain oddities at times, but it like, it's the same creature and it does the same stuff. And then suddenly you introduce something very weird, and yeah, it's kind of an outlier at times. But
let me ask you this question, and I know we're here primarily to talk about UFOs, but in a way, this all kind of groups together. Here's my question. In Bigfoot witness reports, if I have ever heard anyone make a reference to sexual characteristics of the creature they're seeing, it is always female. What say you to that? Have you ever heard of someone saying, I saw Bigfoot and I want to go into details, it was definitely a dude?
No. And like, I mean, how many decades did it take people to realize that the creature in the Patterson-Gimlin film was a female? You know, like,
it took years of
analysis to figure that out.
Yeah, but you look at it now. I mean, now that the film has been, you know, stabilized and sort of, you know, cleaned up, and we're getting the best image that we can now get. Yeah, people are like, oh yeah, that we do seem to see secondary sexual characteristics on whatever this thing is, and it, we appear to be seeing breasts. It appears that it might be a female, which makes the notion of it's a costume even weirder. Because
right.
I don't, for some reason, it doesn't occur to me that a person deciding, wouldn't it be funny if we hoaxed Bigfoot? Let's try to make it appear anatomically correct and female.
Right.
That seems like an odd leap to me. But anyway. Okay. So you and me, we've never heard of, oh, definitely dude Bigfoot, right?
No. Like,
right?
But I also think like, female characteristics are going to be easier to identify than male characteristics, given how hairy this creature supposedly is. And like,
hey, look,
it's gotta be covering up something. I mean, unless
I don't know
Bigfoot's
what websites
packing,
you've been to,
unless somebody's like, hey, Bigfoot's packing, I know it, I saw it. Like, it's going to be a lot easier to identify female characteristics, because they have like a very distinct set of characteristics that are noticeable.
So do guys, Rob. Come on.
Okay, let's if you're looking at a Bigfoot, let me ask you a question. You see a Bigfoot. Are you focusing on the top half or the bottom half?
Look, I'm going to tell you something. If a person is looking at a Bigfoot and they're seeing the whole body, if you're a male or female witness and you see male sex organs, you're going to remember.
So, what does that say about Bigfoot and, what he's packing? Maybe, Bigfoot not that impressive. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. All I'm saying is, look, if I'm walking down the street, there are times when I see someone walking a dog, and I'm like, oh, you should have had that dog fixed. Am I wrong? Have you've had that experience too, right? Okay, that's all I'm saying. All right, now we will move on from this topic. All right. Let's meet Rob Christofferson. You came into my life fully formed as an intellectual, a UFO scholar, a scholar of all things paranormal, supernatural, strange, and anomalous, but primarily UFOs. You are currently located somewhere in upstate New York. Is that where you grew up?
Yeah, I've lived here my whole life. I live in the Adirondacks, which if you Google it, it is the largest state park in the country. So it's absolutely huge.
So you're remote. You're not in what anyone would consider a big city.
The closest city to me is about 100,000 people. And it's about an hour and a half away, or cl pretty close to that.
And that's been your whole life. Okay. So I'm looking at you now. You've got a giant bookshelf behind you. God bless you for that. In your life, when did the strangeness first make an impression on you?
I grew up with primarily Ghostbusters, but not the movies. Like, I watched the movies when I was a kid, but it was a cartoon series, The Real Ghostbusters, that really
Right.
I attached myself to. I watched it religiously as a kid. I had the toys before my parents, I remember one year got me the plastic, it was modeled after the, it wasn't modeled after the movie, it was modeled after the cartoon series, the plastic proton pack, the PKE meter, and the trap. I got that for Christmas one year. That was my life for a good period of time. But like
How old were
growing
you?
up,
I'm thinking 8 years old.
probably 7 or 8, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Because the cartoon came out around the late 80s, early 90s, around that time. And like the weirdness was, I would say it was kind of there from like the time I was a child. The earliest weird experience, and I've had, man, so many. I don't, the funny thing is, I don't have weird experiences anymore. I don't know why that is. But after 2018, I have not had a strange experience since.
Really? But you had them, you're saying you had them somewhat frequently-ish before that?
I would say like maybe it's something that was noticeable, like would pop up every few years, something
Okay.
different. It's always different. But when I was 6 years old, this was Christmas Eve, I had an encounter with a little gnome that walked into my bedroom. And like the way that I describe it, I didn't see its features. It was in silhouette because my door where it was and where it was walking into, like the hallway light was right behind it. So it was in silhouette when it came in. But I remember getting up at like 10:30 Christmas Eve. I remember my parents telling me to go back to bed, that it wasn't time to open presents. And I told them I had to go to the bathroom. So My bedroom was right next to the top landing to the stairs that went down to our front door. Honestly, a terrible place to put a kid if a robber's coming in, because let's be honest, I'm gonna get it first. Like, sure, my parents' bedroom was like right next door, but I'm like, guys, I'm right here. I'm like victim number one. But
You're the human shield.
yeah, basically. And went to the bathroom, went back to bed, and I hopped in bed, and like no more than a couple minutes later, I see this short figure standing right in my doorway. And it has that like signature kind of like silhouette of a gnome. It had like a pointy head, like kind of to make you think that it's like wearing a hat, but just like really short. And it walked into my room, and I don't remember anything after that.
Do you remember how old were you?
About 6 or 7, somewhere around there.
Were you scared? Were you curious?
No. Nope. I wouldn't call it curiosity, but it's just like acceptance, 'cause it's like, oh, it's Christmas Eve. It's got to be like that Santa's kind of real thing, going on. I honestly think that's what went through my head, because I don't recall any kind of fear. But after that, don't remember anything. I just remember falling asleep, or not even remember falling asleep. I just remember waking up, opening presents,
And
and
nothing about that felt like a dream to you. Right. Okay. Okay. So that was when you were very young. And then a little older. I know that we've talked about how I grew up in the in search of generation, and you grew up in the unsolved mysteries generation. So when you were watching TV, that was the place you got your information about weird stuff, right?
I started watching that, oh, man, when I was really young, because Unsolved Mysteries started in like 87, I think, 87, 88, somewhere around there. And the two programs that we would watch religiously every week. On Tuesdays, it was Rescue 911 with William Shatner. And then Fridays, it was Unsolved Mysteries. And I always remember, because like not every week featured an unexplained segment. It was kind of like a rare thing that you would get so many times during a season, but it was generally like the first thing that they would show. And most of the time, it was hauntings and such. Like
Okay.
weird, haunted houses, ghostly encounters that people had, some kinds of psychic phenomenon and such. Like, I know phone calls from the dead is something that you've featured on your podcast before.
Yeah.
And I remember an episode in which there were, I don't know if they featured like the book specifically, but the phenomenon itself, people getting phone calls from relatives who had passed or such. But
How did it feel watching that show?
I was terrified the entire time. Every time. Every time. Like, I kind of remember just like being freaked out most of the time
What is that
watching it.
feeling? What is that thing? Because, like, there are people who would go, yes, I remember seeing scary things, and then I would never watch them again because I didn't like to be terrified. So, what is that thing about certain people where every you're terrified every Friday night, and every Friday night you're back in line for more. What is that?
I think it's just kind of a thrilling feeling that you feel and like want to feel again, and maybe it's something that you can conquer in some way.
Like a roller coaster.
Yeah, basically. But like, I was also conditioned to believe that in my small town, and I'm not saying that this hasn't happened in small towns in New York, that I could be kidnapped at any second. Like, we also watched America's Most Wanted on Saturdays, because that's
Oh
when
my
it was
God,
generally
yeah.
on. And like, I also remember like my mom watched the talk shows, and like there were plenty of talk shows that featured like parents who had missing kids and stuff. So like that was a big thing. It's not even the satanic panic stuff that I remember. It's the like missing children kind of thing.
So you were somehow fixated on the notion of abduction.
Probably a bit, yeah. Yeah, when
Or
I
am
was
I
little.
leading the witness?
No, I mean, you're not wrong. For sure, that was definitely something that I thought of, just because like that idea was just so prevalent. It's a funny story. When I turned 21, I was in college at the time, and I was hanging out with friends. I had a cell phone at the time. I had a track phone.
What's
And
a track phone?
a track phone was it's a pay it was a paid cell phone. You bought minutes for it back in the
Oh,
day.
okay.
And I never called my mom that day, and I didn't get home until normally I'd be home by like, I don't know, like 3 in the afternoon most days. I rarely had a class that went like, there's only one class that I ever had. It was a film class that was at like 5:30 at night, but I rarely was not home by like, I don't know, 3:30, 4 o'clock. Came home, she slapped me in the face because I didn't tell her where I was that day.
Oh my God. Okay.
I mean, my mom didn't hit me that much. Like I remember like maybe two instances of it, but like her kind of thing was like she liked to yell a lot. Like just would fly off the handle about anything and
Like
everything.
big rage.
Basically, yeah, like to the point where I wondered how my dad, like I modeled myself after my dad. I'm probably a little more outspoken, boisterous than my dad was. He was a very stoic person, and he would just like take kind of verbal abuse like it was nothing. And this was a
Right.
guy that was working 3 to 4 jobs at a
Right.
time. So like
Emotionally, your parents sound like my parents. And it's funny you say this, it's that thing where it's like, well, it's like someone talking about their violent boyfriend. Well, he doesn't hit me that much.
Right. Yeah.
And I talk about my that's how I talk about it, that's how you talk about it. And it's like, well, what does that even mean? But anyway, okay. So I understand that experience. When did your first, beyond the gnome, I guess not even first, when did your next in your personal sort of narrative, when did your next paranormal event occur in your life to you?
I don't even know how to describe it. I don't know if it was just like regular kind of kid scared of the dark or something like that. 'Cause there were things that I was scared of as a child that I do remember, including a toy that my grandparents got me when I was very young. It was a giant monster truck that had claws in the tires called the Animal, and it just scared the hell out of me. So like as a joke, sometimes my mom would put this toy in front of my room if she did not want me to leave my room.
As a joke.
I like so like I recognize the abuse in the situation. I think where I always trip up is like, I'm not going to say that there wasn't love there either,
Of
because there
course.
was, but
Of
it's just like
course.
I like humans were not kind of conditioned to live very well with two different things that are polar opposites and reconcile them very well.
Right.
But like I do remember like, they would laugh about it.
Right.
Just because like I don't know, it's a kid scared of a toy.
Big person. To me, it's always a matter of a person whose own coping mechanism sometimes involves acting out in a certain way that is not extremely thoughtful of the other person's feelings about how you may be behaving. So, it falls under the category of, oh, come on, can't you take a joke? As an adult says to a child, which is, weird. But okay, but I get that. So there were things that scared you, but what would you say that our audience would recognize as, oh, that sounds like a paranormal event that occurred to you?
I always got this impression when I would get up early on like Saturday mornings to like watch cartoons that there was someone standing in the doorway watching me in our apartment. Like vague impressions like that.
Did
I
anyone else
remember
have that feeling in your house?
I we it's not something that we would talk about. Like
Right.
it was kind of like I wouldn't say it was like taboo or anything, but it was just like something you didn't talk about because like for me it was like children's entertainment. Ghosts are, this like fun subject that, is on display on a cartoon. But I remember my mother saying that she used to talk to the neighbor and the neighbor would say that her kids were seeing ghosts in their house.
Right. So at what age did UFOs become the focus of your interest?
1997. I remember
Why?
that. So I was 1997, 13, 14, somewhere around there. Unsolved Mysteries aired an episode about the Lonnie Zamora incident. And that's kind of my where it kind of grabbed hold of
Oh,
me.
the Lonnie Zamora? Okay. And that was in Socorro, New Mexico, right? For the people who don't know, can you tell us what the Lonnie Zamora case was?
This is April 1964, Socorro, New Mexico. Lonnie Zamora was a police officer within the town, and towards the end of his shift, late afternoons, like 5:45, there is a car that speeds past him going really fast, and he decides to go pursue it. And as he pursues it, this car is heading out of town. He sees this, what looks like a cone of flame in the sky, and he hears this loud roaring sound. And he thinks that the dynamite shack that is owned by the neighbor is about to explode. So he cuts off the chase and he ends up going towards this arroyo where this, dynamite shack was. And as he's approaching, what he sees at first is what he believes to be an overturned car. Getting a closer look, he notices that there's this egg-shaped object that has landed in this arroyo, and there are two people outside. And he claimed that, and I mean, he saw these people from quite a bit away. I think like half the time it gets depicted that he saw them from closer range, but he was pretty far away at this point. But he said he saw like the mannerisms as if they saw him coming, so they kind of freaked out. He heard as he was approaching, he heard what sounded like the slam of a car door, and before long this object lifts up and it just speeds away. And there were a lot of people that investigated this case, including the FBI, Project Blue Book, and like local police departments and such. And it's one of the few cases that are still labeled as unidentified in the Blue Book files. The Blue Book investigated something like 12,000 cases, and there are 701 that are unidentified, and that case is like the one of maybe like two that involve humanoids that is unidentified.
What is it about that case that captivated you?
I think it had to do largely with Lonnie himself and how he just like, because they interviewed him. It had been decades since anybody had really talked to him. And he just seemed like a very credible, down-to-earth person. And I'm like, okay, so the people that are seeing this stuff are not crazy. They're not like, they're people that have literally just like, if you want to call it right place, right time, wrong place, wrong time, whatever, however you want to call that, because it's going to be different for everybody and in how they view their experiences and what they take away from their experiences. But I think it was Lonnie himself that really did. And I think their depiction of J. Allen Hynek kind of stuck with me, because I do remember we were working on, I think it was, we did this project in middle school English, in which we were split up into groups, and each group dissected a part of the song "We Didn't Start the Fire" by Billy Joel, because it, like the way in which he kind of the lyrics are presented, they're presented by decade, basically. So like
Oh,
everything kind
okay.
of goes in a chronological order for the most part. There are some things that like he had to split up and put into other areas, but like, let me tell you something, man. It was not easy to go look up anything about the Cola Wars on like on co back in the day when the internet was at its youth.
My God, that is so great. The number of teachers who must have used that song as like, oh, I know. I'll use pop music to get to the kids and have them learn history.
But I remember like using the whatever search engine that we had at the time in our school library, and I remember typing the name J. Allen Hynek into it to see if anything would come up, and nothing
Wait a
ever
second, is J.
did.
Allen Hynek name checked in the song?
No, but part of the project was what we would add to it if we could, like,
Oh, okay. Because
yeah.
I'm like,
So,
what rhymes with Hynek?
right. Like, I couldn't think of like anything at the time, but I was just like, I was fascinated enough by that episode. I'm like, I'm just gonna look it up to see if there's anything there, and there
Okay, so you're
wasn't.
already in, as you're in middle school. Okay. So you then embarked on what has now been a decades long sort of independent scholarly project of your own, it feels like to me, to read everything about every available case and sort of have a, sort of a file in your mind of what occurred, where, to whom, and how it relates to other cases. And, I've got my paranormal bookshelf. For you and for the listener, are there like the top three books in terms of UFOs that you were like, these are the seminal books that I go back to all the time, or that resonated with me?
For me, there are varying different degrees of my scholarship in the subject. I think one book that has been the handiest and one that I have read multiple times is The Close Encounters Man by Mark O'Connell. It's that good because it is a biography of J. Allen Hynek, but it's also a very good history of not only like parts of the space race in which Allen Hynek played a part, but you get like this top-down history of the major events of ufology from the 40s all the way up until his death in the 80s. And for that, it's like really compelling, really engaging. Like, J. Allen Hynek is the guy who figured out like he gave UFOs their language, but he also figured out why stars twinkle. Like, how incredible is
Right.
that?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's an astronomer and a, you know, and a hardcore hard science trained academic who then went on a journey of investigating UFOs, debunking UFOs, and then at a certain point realizing not every case can be debunked, and then eventually beginning to reframe his entire understanding of what UFOs are to the point where he entitled one of his books, The UFO Experience. So that it wasn't just, okay, this person saw this here, that person saw that there. He began to think of it as, no, this is more of a syndrome. The way people experience their UFO is as important as the facts that they report that we can then go back retroactively and, you know, correlate somehow to a real event through radar or astronomy or whatever. And you came up with a nickname for J. Allen Hynek that is my favorite thing ever. What do you call him?
UFO dad.
He's our UFO dad. He's the UFO dad. I totally agree with that. You know, we had Mark O'Connell on the show, and I totally agree that it's that book that he wrote, The Close Encounters Man, does sort of give you a real good, it's a good starting point, I think. If you're interested in the subject, I think it's a really good starting point to read that book, kind of get an overview, and then from that book go, okay, now I want to read this and this and this and this and go down this rabbit hole or that rabbit hole. But it's sort of it gets you everything just enough to understand the broad view, right? All right. And then what's another book you would recommend? Or that's meant something to you that sticks with you?
I think Alien Dawn by Colin Wilson is another great book about this subject because it's not, yes, there you go. It's
Just happens to be on my desk. I don't know.
One of those books that I would say he's not afraid to go there in terms
Yeah.
of what he's willing to do. Like, there's that chapter that he has on crop circles is incredible. It's amazing. He kind of puts it into a different context of like just kind of the, I think that's the first place that I ever read of like kind of the supernatural elements in crop circles, just kind of like the weird feelings that people would have and such.
I want to talk about crop circles, but first I want to, I want to talk about Colin Wilson, but let me ask you about crop circles first. Do you believe crop circles are man-made, or do you believe that they are of paranormal origin?
I think there are some people that definitely hoaxed, but I don't think they're all hoaxes. I
So
don't.
you think some are created by something non-human?
I wouldn't say a non-human. So, like my beliefs on like UFOs, the paranormal, and stuff has changed a lot in just like the last like year and year and a half or so.
Really?
Yes.
Oh,
We could
dang.
get into that at some point, but like, I think there is a force that is responsible for it. That force, is it non-human? Yeah, I do believe it's non-human. I just don't think it is the non-human forces that people think it is. I
Like in
think,
the movie Signs.
right, I don't think it's aliens. I don't.
Okay.
But
Do you think
I
it's more
do
of a
think.
poltergeist sort of thing?
Kind of, sort of. It depends on what you think a poltergeist is,
Oh, come
what
on,
it can do.
Rob.
Dude, I'd have to get into the whole kind of theory that I'm running with right now to get into it. But I do think it is a legitimate phenomenon that is caused by something. We can get into it at some
Okay.
point.
Okay.
But
Well, let's circle back. I do want to say Colin Wilson, I'm so glad you brought him up because I love his books because for me, tell me if this is the same for you. For me, his books are like these bibliographies where when I finish one of his books, I have a list of 25 books that I am searching for on, Adol or ABE Books or something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's great for that. And also just a very entertaining writer and just again sort of gives a really good sort of 30,000 foot view of a subject. And then you read it. It's like a big buffet table, and then you can go back to the stuff you like the best and get more of that through the people he refers to. 'Cause he deeply sort of refers to other books in the genre, and many of them early on in my book journey, things I never knew about, and I would find out about book titles from him, and I would order those books, and I would have those books, and I would say a third of the books on my shelf are ones that I got because I found them in a Colin Wilson book. Okay, so we've got Close Encounters Man by Mark O'Connell, we've got Alien Dawn by Colin Wilson. And if, I'm making a big point of this because Christmas is coming up. So you want to get your kids educated. And give me another book or two that you think are if you were going to make a gift basket for the school auction of your starter pack of UFO books, what else would you include?
One that I would include that kind of gets into the dark side of it, and I would recommend too on this Saucers, Spooks and Kooks by Adam Go Rightly, and Messengers of Deception by Jacques Vallée. And I think those both point to how people can warp the subject into something very negative, very not very good. So,
Are we talking about disinformation?
yeah, not just disinformation, but also UFO cults, how bad they can be. But like Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks gets into the 80s disinformation age, which is important, for anybody, because like the way that I always see the topic of UFOs, you have the 40s through the 70s, which are largely, I wouldn't say that disinformation, the nature of disinformation is different from that time to the 80s and beyond. From the 80s and beyond, it is feels more malicious. In the 40s through the 70s, it literally seems like the CIA doesn't want the government dealing with a panic on its hands if Project Blue Book says that we don't know what this is. So we need to mitigate like this moral outrage, this like we don't need a moral panic on our hands, so we're gonna change the game. We know that the CIA made their recommendations, and that Project Blue Book pretty much followed them to the T. That eventually came to light by a guy named James McDonald, James E. McDonald, who was a scientist who was heavily interested in UFOs, was given access to government files in the mid 60s, and the idiots accidentally kept in, I think it was like a memo or something from the Robertson panel, and one of their determinations being like, you need to that the government needs to kind of downplay these reports and then give very like wrong answers to them, come up with like quick solutions to certain sightings and such. So
Now,
like,
go rightly. Have you read Project Beta by Greg Bishop?
yes, yeah, it's also a good book.
Go Rightly and Bishop are clearly, I mean, they've worked together on things, and the idea of people representing the government purposefully misleading citizens who are interested in the UFO subject, that are part of UFO groups or investigating them as just interested parties, and sort of steering them in a direction that can be very damaging, that can literally lead to people committing suicide.
Yep. Yeah, so, exactly.
So Messengers of Deception by Jacques Vallée, who I'm sure the audience knows about, does that book also deal with government disinformation, or what exactly is the area of that book?
It largely focuses on like UFO cults that kind of pop up out of certain UFO beliefs. There is some like government stuff in there, because like Vallée has been, you know, kind of vocally open about like government deception when it comes to UFOs and such. But it like it's largely about like the charlatans that kind of pop up in the subject and convince people to follow them. Because like one of the last things that I researched on this topic before I took all my books and put them out into storage, is that in 1975 there was a lot of like stuff going on with like there were a lot of reported abductions, which was kind of off in that, you know, from previous years, given that one would pop up maybe a year, one every now and then, with the exception of 1973. And I think that's largely just because like there was just a lot of humanoid activity around that year. You know, you had the year of the humanoids being 1973, Pascagoula, just like a lot of very strange cases and stuff. 1975, there were a lot of abductions, but the major uproar in the paper was about Marshall Applewhite getting people starting the origins of his UFO cult started in 75. And you had these very menacing pieces in newspapers about people going missing, being taken in by this guy, people just upending their lives and such, and going off with him and, you know, under this, like, you know, UFO belief. Like, he would be going all over the United States, like just giving talks and stuff like that, people showing up and then uprooting their lives and stuff. So,
and his
like,
message was, come with me, join my cult, and we are going to, there's going to be sort of a rapture equivalent, except facilitated by you, a UFO. Is that the idea?
I think that's what it eventually became, but I don't think it was that just yet. Like, okay. Like the UFO belief, like most of that was like generated because Hale Bopp was coming around. So like, you know, you got this belief that there's a UFO going behind it, and like, we're going to kill ourselves so we can, go join, you know, with this UFO, we'll join on board and stuff. But now, I don't think it was that extreme at that point.
In your opinion, was Applewhite, I want to say, genuine or authentic in his belief? Did he, for any reason, was there anything about that cult that made it feel like, oh no, he was just totally lying so that he could steal money or something? Like, where was he? How did he actually really feel, do you think?
That's the tough thing, man, is like, so we have this one incident that happened, you know, a mass suicide, but like,
which was in 1997.
Right. And to be honest, I don't know enough on the topic to really totally commit myself to anything, but like,
it's so funny you bring it up, because when I was talking to Blake Smith, who you know, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the event, and that was the year that sort of drew him toward skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so frightening to him that people who were otherwise appeared to be pretty solid, intelligent, you know, non-vulnerable people became very, very vulnerable to this guy and his cult, and ended up losing their lives.
Right.
And that for Blake, I think that so disturbed him because he's like, when I hear about these people, they sound like me, you know? And could I ever be seduced into something so self-destructive? And his answer was, I think I really need to go the other way. I think I really need to sort of gird myself in a level of materialism and a level of rationalism that feels like I know now how to view these paranormal beliefs. And that is if I just really stay oriented in a place of rationalism, I will be safe from ever being seduced into that, because clearly anyone can be.
Right. Yeah. The number of stories I've heard about cults around reptilians these days is insane, because there are literally people killing people over it.
And when you say reptilians, you're sort of saying it in a sense of this being one of the more outlandish, quote unquote, ridiculous beliefs a person could have.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't start with David Icke, but David Icke took it to such a place that it became so toxic that people have bought into it so much, and that it has taken on a life of its own, to the point where I don't even think most people connect that kind of belief to him. Maybe some of them do, but I mean, that Tennessee Christmas bomber, like a few years ago, he had beliefs in reptilians. I remember reading a story, newspaper story, I can't remember how many years ago at this point, maybe like 4 or 5, of a woman who's part of one of those kind of cults murdering her husband over it. And like that nature of it is, it's always there. And you can see it in communities. Like, the tribalism around this topic is scary at times.
Well, it's based
there are
in
people.
It's based in paranoia. And
a lot of it is. Yeah.
Paranoia is this sort of, you know, a lot of unexpressed feelings of depression and rage that are then projected outward. Now, so it begins as a feeling, it's projected outward. And once that happens, it can express itself in any way, politically, with the theories about, you know, paranormal theories or satanic panic or all kinds of things. You know, paranoia just needs something to attach itself to.
Right. Right. I think one of the worst examples of that is Carla Turner, who...
Tell us about that. What is that? Who is that?
Carla Turner, was a teacher who, due to... She issued, like... it was like a school assignment that she gave to her students about a...
When was this?
This was in the 80s.
Okay.
She gave a school assignment to her class. She was an English teacher, and it was about like conspiracy theories and stuff. Conspiracy theories, the paranormal, stuff like that. And she bought into it so much that she had convinced herself. And I'm sure like there are certain people who, when they hear me talk about this, are going to be upset, because it's like, you're not taking an experiencer at face value, but like if you read into her story, you can see where someone bought into the belief that they were an abductee, that her husband was an abductee, so much that it became pure paranoia. She wrote a couple of books on the subject, Into the Fringe. I forget what the other one is called, but you can definitely get down that rabbit hole. It's easy to get down that rabbit hole. It's the same.
So what happened with her? She gave this assignment. You're saying her husband had been abducted, or she believed he had been abducted,
yeah,
and this led to a belief system of hers or what?
Basically, yeah. She'd written a couple books about the subject, but a lot of it's just like paranoia on full display. And
What eventually happened?
She contracted cancer and died
Oh,
in the
okay. So she
90s.
didn't act actually. It's not like she,
No, but
killed.
people believe that the aliens gave her the cancer. Like, some people came away believing that.
Oh, that she was being punished for.
Yeah, it's kind of like certain conspiracy theorists believing that John Mack was intentionally run over, you know, stuff like that.
Right. John Mack being the Harvard psychologist who studied people who had alien abduction experiences and came to believe that they were not suffering from mental illness, that they were suffering from PTSD based on something that appeared to be a thing we don't understand, which is alien abduction. He died in a car accident run down by a car in London.
Yeah, he was at a conference for, I believe, the Lawrence of Arabia, because he had written quote unquote psychological biography of Lawrence of Arabia. I have it somewhere
Early
around
on.
here.
I mean, that was before the UFO stuff.
Yeah, he won the Pulitzer Prize for it. So,
and so people believe that he was run down intentionally because he knew something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, by that time, he had largely stopped his research into the topic. Like, he had gotten as far as he could with it, you know.
Right.
So, I don't understand that line of logic, but like, it is easy. And I've even found myself with certain things about this topic. It's easy to kind of bend it at times to fit a narrative. And
well,
to
I
take
think when
it
you
into directions.
When you believe that another human being, quote unquote, has the answer and isn't telling you, that feels like a basis for paranoia, which is one of the reasons that I, again, find myself advocating for the middle road, the Fortean questioning road, where you come from a place of the question is unanswered. No one is hiding something from you. No one, there is no group of people that possesses knowledge that they won't give you, that they're not sharing, that must be disclosed. That these things are still true mysteries and can be looked at as such. And if you can resist the human impulse to immediately give it an answer or dismiss it as a question, you can move forward without giving into paranoia. Does that make sense?
Right.
Thank you. I am correct. That's all I ever ask from Rob. Just tell me I'm right and send me on my way. Remember when I solved alien abductions for you?
Yeah, but I don't believe that. I don't ascribe to your beliefs on that at this point. But like, that's
what,
just
you
me.
Don't believe in my solution anymore?
No, my beliefs on this topic have changed a lot in the last year and a half. And
okay,
like,
well, let me ask you, can you paraphrase for me what your beliefs were and what they are now? Sort of what they've evolved into.
I don't believe that all of this stuff, whether it's UFOs, you know, aliens, cryptids, and such, I don't think it, like, I lump all this kind of stuff together, because I am of the mind that it's all coming from a singular source. Like, that's my belief at this point. And I don't believe that source is out there. I literally think it is the Earth itself. And the reason that I think that, and it's crazy when you say this, when it comes to UFO encounters, humanoid encounters and stuff, there's always a message about environmentalism. To be honest, if aliens were coming here, I do not think they would give one iota shit about environmentalism in the Earth. We're fucking, the galaxy is ever expanding, and there are like infinite galaxies and shit out there. Like space is continuing to expand. And like that idea that aliens would come here to tell us to give a shit about the environment makes no fucking sense to me whatsoever. Like and like the thought occurs to me that like, what if these aliens are just some other planet's billionaires and like we're dealing with their bullshit, Like that's the thought that entered my head. But again,
We got
I
enough
don't think
problem
they
with our
would.
own billionaires.
Yeah, we do. But like, there's always an environmental message. Like a lot of
Right.
people have come up with the similar environmental message.
B
Bigfoot
bo both in
itself,
alien encounters and in near-death experiences.
right? Bigfoot itself is an environmental message. Right there. It's literally something you encounter in the environment. And there are so many stories from First Nations folklore about these creatures. Like, I've read stories about, these creatures being kind of like the go-between between like in First Nations folklore, where these Bigfoot type creatures are go-betweens between the humans and the animals that they hunt, and like
Right.
trying to maintain that relationship and stuff. Like all of those kind of creatures are all over native folklore. That's an environmental message in and of itself. And to a certain extent, spirit phenomenon, depending upon how you believe it gets there, it's an environmental message because it is imprinted on the environment itself. Like whatever these are, like they are part of the environment. Like they keep appearing there, especially if you get into like the stone tape theory kind of stuff, that's connected to environment.
Well, now wait a second. Hold on. People will talk about an alien abduction experience, and often they will say that an alien explicitly indicates to them in some way, your Earth is headed toward disaster, either through nuclear annihilation or an environmental disaster based in pollution and, fluorocarbons and, climate change, basically. Okay. And that's been going on for a long time. And there have also been messages in near-death experiences that echo that also. Now, I don't know of ghost encounters where the message from the ghost is your planet is headed toward environmental disaster that will result in the death of hundreds of millions of people. I haven't heard that. Is that we, but you're saying that that is true?
I think it's all part of the same thing. Like I think there are messages embedded in each of these phenomena that have to do with the earth itself, like and how
Okay.
it's related to it. Like spirits in a lot of ways are like an anchoring point because they are attached to the earth itself. Like for some reason they're still doing what they're doing. I'm also of the belief that like if you try to categorize this stuff a little too much, you kind of lose sight of what it may actually be. So if you stick it into a category, even though it has a certain appearance, at like, you got a UFO, you categorize it as a UFO, you got a Bigfoot, you categorize it as a Bigfoot and stuff like that. When you start categorizing things, I think you kind of lose a little sense of what this may all be because I don't think the Earth is that weird that it has that much weird, like diversified weird stuff going on.
You
So
think it's
I think it's
speaking
all
with one
related.
voice that somehow is expressed in a variety of ways?
Yes. Yeah. That's pretty much what I think. And I think that voice is the earth itself. One thing that I really attached myself to for a period of time was the work of David Perkins, who worked on cattle mutilations and stuff for like 40 years. And there's that Gaia theory that the Earth is like a living being in and of itself, and it does what it needs to survive and stuff like that. But I think I think it goes a little more beyond that into like it arranges these experiences for people for various certain ways or for certain purposes. And that a lot of it I just think is tied to whether it's purpose in life, whether it is trying to remind you that the place in which you actually live is magical as hell, and you should take notice of that every day. All of these phenomenon are like inspirational. Like they've inspired me in the art that I do with my buddy Todd and stuff. I think they carry a lot of different messages. So for me, it's not so much the pursuit of individual cases, whereas it's trying to decipher a message and apply it to my life somewhere.
That's really interesting, and I think that's what many of us do. We're reading these kinds of books, and we're enjoying the mystery and the question, but it does reflect back on us and how we live our lives. And I'm actually really glad that's kind of where you're drifting with your research and your philosophy. Would you say you're getting to a more, if not optimistic, a more balanced, grounded place?
I think there's a lot of hope in encounters that people have. I'm not going to say that there isn't trauma there, because there's definitely trauma there. Like a lot of these are traumatizing incidents, but like another book that I'll tie into this that I would recommend people read is Somewhere in the Skies by Ryan Sprague, which is a phenomenal book that I think everybody should go and read. And it's not because I have my own personal experience in that book. That's not why I'm saying it. I'm saying it because there are many cases in that book where it feels as if you can see how UFO encounters directly affected someone's lives and put them on a trajectory to ultimately where they ended up. You
And what is
know,
that, a positive trajectory or a?
Like, yeah, like giving people life purpose. There's one guy in that book that, after his encounter, he went and became an actor, you know, and there's another one that became a pastor and stuff. So, like,
A lot of
even
people
on
would
that,
not say those are two good things.
right, exactly, you know, and I mean, man, you've worked with some actors, so, you know,
I think I know who you're talking about.
yeah,
Rob,
but like,
I feel like we've skipped over something essential, which is your actual experience. Can you tell us what your most profound experience was? Either the one in the Sprague book or, I mean, what is your sort of seminal experience?
I kind of look at two experiences as being the ones that have set me like on this journey. So the first one is the lizard creature that I had an encounter with.
Wait, what? So you had an encounter with a lizard creature?
So yeah, this is 2012, August. It was a really hot morning. It was humid as hell. I remember that. The shift that I worked at the time was 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. So you know, I was going to work early. Taking my typical route, I turned down the one street that I always cut through.
On foot or by car?
On foot. So fun fact, I don't have a driver's license. I've never had a driver's license. I walk everywhere. And I cut down the street walking. The one thing about me that if you ever know me in person, I'm wearing headphones all the time, and a large part of that is neurodivergence. I am neurodivergent as hell. Like I have audio processing issues at times, so I just wear headphones all the time. I also wouldn't be surprised if that's why I'm the encyclopedia that I am in this subject. It's just like it's that urge to focus on something, you know, intensely. So,
Right. Are the headphones playing anything, or are they just a way to cut out a little input and to also signal to people that I'm not open for communication.
Most of the time I'm playing something, but sometimes I'm just like, I just need to tune everything else out.
Got it.
So got my headphones on, listening to music. I can see something down the street on this one person's lawn. And at
what
first
time
I think
is
it's
it, and what, how light has sunrise occurred?
No, sunrise hasn't occurred yet. It's probably like 4:15, 4:30 in the morning.
Kind of full dark.
Yeah. But street lights, it's like the streets are plenty lit. And I can see something on, like, some animal of some kind on this person's lawn further down the road. And I'm thinking it's a deer because you see, like, where I live is like right next to the woods. There's, you can see deer. Deer's like the main thing that you'll see. Sometimes you get a bear in town. Sometimes you will get, see some foxes. I've seen coyotes. You, like, a couple weeks ago, I was heading to work. And right at the end of my street is like right next to the woods. And I was hearing coyotes howling, you know, early in the morning. So,
right. How big was this thing? How big, the thing that you were looking at, based on its size, you thought it was a deer or a bear?
Something like that. Yeah. It was like hunched over at the time when I was noticing it.
Well, I mean, a deer is on 4 feet. A bear is on, well, I guess it's on 4 feet too. Okay.
Yeah. So I get closer and closer. I'm not really paying attention to it the whole time as I'm walking down there, because I figure if it's a deer, it's going to run off on its own. Like, the typical response you'll get from deer, especially here, is like they'll stare at you for like 10 seconds, 10 to 15 seconds, and then they'll run off.
Right.
So I'm thinking like, oh, this is a deer. It's going to poke its head up and it's going to notice me. I get to about 25 to 30 feet away from this thing, and it stands up on two legs, and it turns and it looks at me, and it's standing directly under a streetlight, on this person's lawn, which I found interesting. And it looked like the way in which you see like a reptilian creature being like depicted. It had very scaly skin. It was kind of skinny. It wasn't robust or anything like that. The only thing that was really different is the face. The face looked more like when you see a reptilian creature depicted, like its facial features are kind of exaggerated. It's got like big eyes, kind of a like a an extended snout, a little bit and stuff. This
right.
thing had kind of like a, I'm not going to say a normal human face, but its features were closer to ours in that they were smaller, kind of
Okay.
more mute. But like this, we stared at each other for a few seconds, and then the yard in which this creature was standing on, there was a slight incline, probably like 4 or 5 feet to get up and then to the top, and it pretty much vaulted that in nothing and just ran into this person's backyard.
Was it wearing clothes, or was it?
No. Naked
So
as a jaybird.
did it have a tail?
Yes, it had quite a long tail that actually came up. I would say the tail is probably like maybe 3 feet long.
Male or female?
Couldn't tell because like there was a shadow.
Was it pixelated?
No. I don't, man, I can't say because like of the female features that would be there, if there were any, there were none. So maybe it was a dude.
Like maybe a dude, or maybe we don't know with the reptilians,
right,
how they categorize themselves.
Right. So
how did you feel?
Slightly freaked, but not scared.
And where did it go?
Just ran into this person's backyard. I didn't see where it went, like, after that, because I couldn't. It was dark.
It jumped over a fence into their backyard.
It wasn't a fence. It was just like a steep little hill that it needed to get up over.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm thinking of LA backyards where everything has a fence and a border, whereas in many other parts of the country, the yards kind of blend into each other. Got it. And how tall was it again?
Probably like 4.5 feet tall.
Oh, not super tall, like shorter than you. Okay. All right. And it went away, and then you just continued on to work.
Yeah, man, it went on about my day, and to be honest, I kind of forgot about it. Just got into the routine of my day.
You're saying this did have an impact on your future scholarship.
Oh yeah, I would definitely say so. Like, I would say that's probably up there for the weirdest thing that I've ever experienced, because it's just like I've never heard of anybody reporting seeing anything like that in this area. There's no stories of anybody seeing reptilian creatures
This is not
in
part
the
of local
Adirondacks.
folklore.
Like, you get Bigfoot sightings up here. You'll get, you got a fair share of UFO accounts. Like, this place is haunted as hell, but like Lizard Man, not of the lore around here.
Okay. So for the work that you're doing, you go on podcasts, you have done your own podcast. What do you see in your future in this subject matter?
I'm done with UFOs for now. I've reached a conclusion. Like, I can't learn anything more from this subject by reading another case or diving into those books. I've read those books. There's nothing else that I can glean from it. For me, I'm reading more books about ghosts right now and spirit phenomenon and stuff like that. And I mean, I started in spirit phenomenon because before I got into UFOs and the podcast, I was a paranormal investigator for about 10 years. And
In what sense?
I was part of a group. We went out, we investigated places, we had people that contacted us and such. And
Local area, somebody else drove.
yep, pretty much. That's how it went. For about 10 years,
Did you
from about,
come away from that experience feeling like, yes, there is spirit phenomenon?
I would say that I honed in, like, I don't want to fully say it's like a psychic sense, but it's just like I had a lot of personal encounters with spirits around that time.
Okay.
Because they would just kind of attach themselves to me for a while and just hang out.
So clearly you came away a believer, not a skeptic. Yeah. Is there a book in your future?
I've tried, and I just don't have it in me yet. I don't think it's something that I th it may be in the future at some point, but it's just like I went as far as I could with one subject. I thought I was going to write a book about it, and every time that I've tried to pick up a book to just like do research and like map out what I want to do, I can't do it. My brain will just not let me do it.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, it's just like it's almost like my brain is bored with it. It's like, you've already done this. Do you want to do this? So, like, for me right now, I'm focusing on writing, but it's not that kind of writing. It's I'm writing short stories, I'm writing poetry, I'm writing kind of essay pieces and stuff, and just like trying to hone that right now. Like, it's not so much the weirdness aspect, although like the ghost books kind of tie into things a little weirdly, in the way that I'm approaching a writing project that I'll have coming out soon.
Okay.
But for me, I don't really need to continue with UFOs because I've done it. And I know that upsets people because I'll get messages every now and then saying like, please bring back the podcast, please, release something. And it's like, I can't. When something is not fulfilling for me anymore. I can't do it. Like, my brain just puts up so many robots. Like, when I describe it to people, it's like literally I'll start yawning like crazy and I'll get drowsy. I can't read a book
Yeah.
about the subject. I've done it, and I'm not someone that wants to beat a dead horse. Like, I've evolved as much as I can in this top in this subject, because from where it started to where it ended, I think I came away with a good appreciation of what the topic had to offer. And I think that will help me in the future in terms of like the nuance that it had to offer. Like, not just the UFOs, not just the aliens, but like the intersection where like the paranormal phenomenon happened, the poltergeist that, phenomenon that occurred to certain people in certain circumstances following their UFO encounters. And like how some people encountered aliens in like the way that you would encounter a ghost or stuff like that. Like,
Right.
it gave me a lot of nuance, and it taught me the value of nuance, because when you see a particular phenomenon in a stiff and rigid structure, you don't see all the things that it can do. You don't see how it can all be related, because again, it comes down to like this kind of like tribalism thing. And
Right.
I don't really like to, I don't engage with that anymore. For a long time, there was definitely one side. Like, if you want to divide the UFO community into groups, there's one side that's the disclosure side, and then there's the other side that's like the history side. And to be honest with you, both sides are fucking insufferable. And I'll be honest, I was one of those insufferable people for a long, long time. Like, when you're when you're debating on the merits of the term UAP and UFO, it's just like, what are we even doing here? Like, what is this? And I'm gonna be honest to the UFO crowd, the folks that believe that UFOs can be really weird, UAP is a better term to describe them. It just is. It's also a very old term. It goes back to the 40s. So, like, because it's been taken over by a group of people that you don't see eye to eye with, it's incredibly toxic.
I feel like a lot of what you're talking about, these sort of categorizations that may or may not be as legit as we once thought, are a result of the publishing industry.
Part of it, yeah, absolutely.
Because you're putting out a product for interested readers, and I think there was a point where in decades past, the feeling was, well, we need to, people are interested in UFOs. We need to get some UFO books in our catalog. Or conversely, people always love ghost stories. Isn't there a new way to approach the idea of haunted houses or ghost stories to put them out, either in terms of, regional or, type or whatever? Or, we, our audience is an outdoor audience. They enjoy camping, they enjoy hunting. Is there a Bigfoot book that sort of feeds that interest? And so we were taught when we would go into a bookstore or look at a catalog that there were categories. And these were people trying to fulfill, customer needs and also, earn money. And now we're in an era of podcasting where we can get the full story, where a podcast can just be about, we're about all kinds of strange phenomenon. And so we're not going to cut you off if you're telling a Bigfoot story that blends into a UFO story, right?
And I think that's where like the value of publications back in the day, like Fate magazine, like because they published everything. Like, it was nothing
Oh,
was
yeah.
off the table. You would get an issue that had like some ghostly encounter, and there's a UFO on the next page, and stuff like that. Like, diversify your weirdness, people. Like,
Well,
it
it's
is.
funny because, like you say, Fate magazine did that, but within the stories, they didn't do that.
Right. Yeah.
There were no stories about necessarily, you could probably find one, but you know, Bigfoot on a UFO question mark.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like I asked you a question about if there are any books about people who have had encounters with spirits of people who are still living.
Yes.
And the one thing that you said to me is like doppelgangers, and like that's not what I'm talking about. Like, because doppelganger like kind of assumes like a physicality of some kind, but I'm literally talking about like there was a story I read in which this woman saw the spirit of this man in their garden, and he was I can't remember exactly. It's in Roger Clark's book, The Natural History of Ghosts,
right?
Because he has a categorization scale for ghosts, and one of them is like living spirits.
Sure.
And this one researcher claimed to see a spirit of this researcher who ended up paying a visit to their home. So like saw this like ghostly image of him in their garden, and then it disappeared. So like it's
but it was
kind
a
of
living person that they knew was still alive.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so well, and then we got into the subject of the we're like, oh wait, there's a famous Phantasms of the Living.
Yes, which amazingly I got both volumes in one. I don't know how that happened, but
that's great. So you've got at least got a reference volume right there for you.
That's, man, Roger Clark's book, it's kind of like Colin Wilson's book, because he like cites so many books, and I'm like, God damn it, I want to go read this, I want to go read that. Like, there are a few books that I've picked up that he's mentioned in his book, just from it, and it's like, and I keep telling myself, it's like, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, because like I did that for 10 years with UFOs, and now I have a bunch of books. Like, I have, man, if I had to guess what I spent on books during that period of time, I want to say, man, I spent probably 10 grand in 10 years.
Yeah.
So like a grand a year.
Easily you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not even hard to do.
No.
And then you've
not.
Got the books. They're in your home.
Yeah.
Taking up space, and you feel this sort of dominion over them. You want they're part of you. They're an extension of you. They're an extension of your thoughts, and you want to be able to access them whenever you want. And yet at the same time, suddenly they're taking up more room than you.
Yeah. And now I feel entirely alienated from the subject. So we have a very weird relationship, me and these books.
Alienated from the subject. Very
exactly.
Good, Rob.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. Closing thoughts. What do we go away with? We're in October. Halloween's coming up. How do we approach these things in our lives?
Well, I think my favorite thing about Halloween is, and I don't know that many people look at it this way, because like it's where like you can put a mask on and just kind of be something else for a period of time. Like, yeah, there's the scary and spooky stuff, but it's that kind of time period where you can kind of dress up your trauma and unleash it on the world in a safe manner. And I think that's what I appreciate about this holiday more than everything, on top of the candy, man. Candy is great. Not much
God.
Of a drinker anymore, but getting drunk wearing a costume is absolutely phenomenal.
It's
definitely
fantastic.
A great time. Yeah,
there's
it
maybe
really
nothing
is.
better.
Yeah, like,
okay.
I mean, who wouldn't want to see a drunk Mothman just falling around in some bar or something like that, you know?
Dude, I think I lived through that a couple weekends ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, really quick, finish up top three candy bars.
Oh man. For me, Nestle's Crunch. I love a
Yep.
crunch bar. I love the crunch of that bar. I love Kit Kats. Kit Kats are
Nice.
fantastic. And I
Also
think,
crunchy.
yeah, also crunchy. And then Snickers. Can't go wrong with the Snickers.
Okay, interesting. I would say my number one all time is the 100 grand bar.
That's fair. That's a very tasty bar.
Yeah. I love that. I love the Milky Way, just the straight ahead Milky Way. And I don't know, third, I mean, Snickers good, but maybe some kind of does the Reese's cup count as a candy bar?
I think if they're sold with the candy bars, it's a candy bar. Sure,
Yeah,
it's a
yeah.
cup, but
Yeah.
it's a candy bar that has individuality, and
Yeah.
that's important. It's a candy bar that's being itself, which is a cup. And how can you not respect a piece of candy that has the ability to be itself in its own form, in its own wrapper, sexy like that, in that orange? It's just a beautiful thing.
Dude, thank you so much for coming on the show. I have missed these conversations, and hopefully there'll be more in the future.
Yeah, dude, I appreciate it. I enjoy the fact that I can just come on here and be an absolute lunatic, and I'm so down for being a greater lunatic further down the road. Happy to come back on and just be completely weird and neurodivergent and shit, because I don't need to ham it up for my own podcast. I can ham it up for myself now.
I love that. All right, man. Take care. Love you.
Love you too, man.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.